Blog Talk Radio.
I'd like to welcome everybody to today's episode of On Point with your host Ron Edwards and myself Don Allen, broadcasting live from downtown Minneapolis on a semi-partly cloudy day. How you doing today, Mr. Edwards?
Fine, Mr. Allen. You yourself?
I'm doing absolutely wonderful today. Let's get right into it. What's going on the international scene here?
Well, Don, what we're going to do is take a quick look at the international scene as a part of our international segment. The conflict in Central Asia, Kyrgyzstan, a small country surrounded by it itself was a part of the former Soviet Union.
Yes.
Ethnic violence there, Uzbekis, as they're called, are the target of apparently ethnic cleansing, and particularly in the south of the country. Now, this is basically a very small enclave, and for those listeners who are able to also divert to their GPS, they'll know what we're talking about. Thousands, in fact, 300,000 Uzbeki from Kyrgyzstan have fled to Uzbekistan, which is a country just to the west of Kyrgyzstan. But one of the things that no one has really ever examined, paid any attention to, the United States and the Soviets were both asked to consider sending in military forces. It's been pretty brutal against the Uzbekis by the Kyrgyzstani, both armed forces and militia. A lot of folks have never paid any attention that the United States, very quietly a couple years ago, placed a massive air base in the northern part of Kyrgyzstan, which is not that much distance from Afghanistan, because the base is used to supply and reinforce American forces in Afghanistan because of problems bringing and routing supplies through Pakistan, okay? But also, this base is still in close proximity to northern Iran, and particularly to some of Iran's nuclear facilities in the eastern part of Iran. And again, if you listen to some of the foreign language broadcast in English coming out of that part of the world, for quite some time, the Iranians have indicated that they're pretty much aware of what the United States is up to with respect to this base. But also, Don, for those, again, who have the GPS capabilities, if you look at Kyrgyzstan, and if you know where the location of the air base is, there's also a Soviet air base in that same area. The United States also placed that air base there to do a little bit of spying on China's nuclear facilities.
Yes.
China has nuclear facilities, testing facilities, long-range missile facilities, and et cetera, in that part of northwestern China. And you have to take a look at the map to get a better understanding. And what has been happening is that the United States, because there was a problem with the satellite spying, and if you do not reposition your satellites and et cetera, there are many occasions when certain things will be missed, such as downrange rocket testing, other kinds of military exercise. So anyways, the close proximity of this American airbase, and it's a massive airbase, by the way, Don. It's a very, very large airbase, just as large as Bagan, which is in Afghanistan. And once the request was made for possible military intervention and assistance, of course, the Soviets said, we're not going to go in. The United States is not going to go in unless it's a United Nations mandate. But the other problem is Kyrgyzstan has a common border with China, a fairly long common border, let's say probably about 700, 800 miles. And, of course, the Chinese smile and let the United States know that they did not think kindly of a United States military presence, again, that close to their sovereign borders, particularly that close to their nuclear facilities. So it's a situation you need to keep an eye on. Hundreds, if not thousands, are being murdered and killed and raped and et cetera, and the big powers have refused to step in. And, again, we have almost a repeat of what happened in where? Sarajevo. the former Yugoslavia, okay, when Serbia was running amok in Kosovo and Montenegro, and whole situation with the Albanians. So it's something that you want to keep your eye on. It has a strong international flavor. A lot of discussions going on amongst international bloggers.
Okay. Well, thanks for that update. We're looking at some news here now coming in from the Middle East. 11 killed as militants storm Yemen jail.
Wow.
They're pointing to Al-Qaeda. The Turks and Kurdish rebels clash after a raid on posts. So we have a lot of activity on there, and that's in Afghanistan. And so it's very interesting. Moving on, if you choose to do so,
I
want to look at our next topic. We're going to kind of bring it kind of close to home, but not home yet. But we're looking again this week for our fourth episode here is at the oil spill in the Gulf.
Okay, I understand you've got a couple of editorial highlights making fun of BP.
Yeah, it's very interesting. The first one, I'll let you take the first one about BP's CEO there. And then I have a couple other things here, too.
Well, you know, the CEO of British Petroleum appeared before a very, very hostile congressional committee a couple days ago in Washington. And it was interesting the back and forth that went on. I mean, they really pounded on him. And of course, if I was somebody living in Louisiana or if I was an environmentalist and I understood what was happening, I'd be extremely angry also. As I said before, people continue to talk in terms that this will surpass Katrina until they start losing the number of lives that were lost in Katrina, which 90% were African Americans, and maybe I will understand that. But as an environmentalist and as a person who has served as the head of an environmental program for a major American corporation, I understand what people are saying. And so within 24 hours after the CEO's testimony, he relinquished direct day-to-day responsibilities for the cleanup. And then, of course, there is this quote-unquote conservative anger in America against President Obama for extracting from BP a $20 billion quote-unquote relief fund, $20 billion, to help pay for the damages and other circumstances that have emerged, including the loss of revenue to businesses and et cetera in the Gulf area. Many people, though I wasn't, Don, were shocked when Representative Barton of Texas, whose district is in the Houston area, he is one of the largest recipients of petroleum monies. When I talk about monies, I'm talking about for his campaign and et cetera. He apologized to BP's CEO and called President Barack Obama an extortionist.
Okay.
And it became so ugly within the same day, within hours, in fact, the minority whip out of Ohio called a special session, took him into the whipping shed. And when they came back for the afternoon session, Barton of Texas apologized profusely. But the Democrats, led by the Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden, leaped upon this, and the Democrats are hoping that it serves as some kind of a platform to stem what have been severe drops in opinion polls and et cetera. On this end, as a talk show blogger, I think the president is doing everything he can. You know, last week it was on this program that we suggested that the president needed to consider placing some portions of BP's operation in receivership. Looks like maybe somebody in Washington was listening, because that's really what the president is moving towards. And the $20 billion quote-unquote payment or fund that he is required BP to establish is a step in that direction.
Yes, exactly. And I'm looking at, I'm referring here to the Van Nuys Daily News.
California? Okay.
Out of California. And we're looking at the estimated leak amount, and they expected to leak more than 120 million gallons, okay? And as you just said, the House Judiciary Committee says BP has paid out less than 12%, which is only 71 million of the estimated 600 million of claims submitted by people and businesses arising from the Gulf oil spill. Another thing that's been happening is, you know, this is news, but it turns into a slow news day because on Wednesday, the front cover of several national newspapers have sea creatures flee the oil spill, gather near shore.
Right.
And I'm supposing that you can't mess with Mother Nature and things that are going on like that. And I just look at some of these, the cartoons, the political cartoons that have come out. And if you go to DailyNewsLosAngeles.com, you will see a lot of these examples of not making fun at the oil spill or what's going on there, but some of the headlines of different periodicals around the United States, you know, focusing on the sea creatures. The one that I have has a dolphin.
Pelican?
Yeah, well, no, this one has a dolphin
this
out of the water.
Wow. Okay.
Like he's
okay.
Waving at everybody. But yeah,
man.
and so.
But he's not breathing. I mean, yeah, right. I know. I understand what you're saying, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'm just looking at that here, and you know, we're concerned about the oil spill or the oil leak, and it depends on what week and what news channel you look at.
Okay. By the way, keep in mind for our listeners, particularly in the South and in the Gulf region. I mean, we up here in Minnesota clearly understand the pelican is the Louisiana state bird. That is, you know, it's a lot of sense of pride that's at play. And anger with respect to the kind of indifference shown by BP with respect to what's happening to the pelican population in the marshlands in that part of Louisiana and the southern part of the Gulf. Yep.
Okay, and moving right along here, we had a very interesting week here in the Twin Cities. A lot of different things went down, a lot of political moves, a lot of community actions, and I actually want to tell you a little bit just to kind of dig in here and then get to our topic. I had a chance to go out to the Juneteenth celebration here in the Twin Cities, which was held
at the taking place this morning or this afternoon as we speak, I understand.
Yeah, it's toward the tail end right now, and I went out kind of early because I just wanted to see those of you that don't know Minneapolis or Twin Cities. It's normally held in an area really close to North Minneapolis, which has one of the most highest black populations in the Twin Cities, and at a park called Worth Park. This time they moved it out to Mississippi Regional Park, which is out the border line of another suburb called Brooklyn Center. And one of the main complaints that I heard from attendees was that you had to park so far away. And this is even before I got there. So when I arrived, I thought that I'd pull into the parking lot because, you know, that park has ample parking out there. But the Minneapolis police, Brooklyn Center police, the Fridley and Crystal police had it blocked off. So you had to go across 94, which is the highway here, and park in the residential area. And I ended up walking the equivalent of about four blocks. I'm not complaining, but I'm just saying that's kind of one of the main.
So in other words, you had to walk back over the bridge over 94. You had to come back across the bridge and then go down into the park. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
And they did have buses and shuttles running back to drop them off right at that opening point. But, you know, a lot of the elderly people that I talked to and interviewed, and you can look at those interviews at IBNN.org. Actually, it's IBNN.org on the YouTube channel, which I posted. I did interviews with some elderly folks, and Mr. Jerome Copeland gave me a very good interview and a couple other folks. And that was one of the main complaints. It's behind a big wall, a barrier over there. But for the most part, they had a
by the way, just so our listening audience, it's a sound barrier constructed
yes.
by DOT. Right. Okay. Okay.
Yes, and they're back on the other side of the wall, and I was also kind of surprised at the number of people that were pulling up, getting off 94, because, you know, right there at 53rd, there is an exit to get off the freeway,
right.
And a lot of people were winding down the windows and asking, well, what's going on? What's going on over here? And the traffic jam was all the way back down to the end of the ramp. So that's what kind of happened today. But to get in our topic, Mr. Edwards, we had talked earlier this week about the different situations of African Americans, the different things that they were going through here in the Twin Cities, and you had brought up a very interesting point, was when did the revolution stop? When did we decide that to give up, or some blinded by, you know, some kind of false reality that everything's okay now, and this is not an attack against Obama at all, but we have a black president, and and everything is fine, and we don't need, as a race of African-American men and women, don't have to work any more harder than what we've been doing in the past. And we found out in some different reports and different stories that, yeah, we have to work even more hard right now to get where we need to get, because the struggle is not over. But our question is, you know, why are Black Americans still having firsts in 2010? And when did the revolution stop?
Well, I think there it happened at different intervals. And also the intervals have to do with geography. Some places, you know, it cease and desist earlier than others, if you will. It had to, I think, really begin to heighten itself during the 1980s, when there seemed to be a sense that things had improved and et cetera. Though there were studies, independent studies, and research data that was indicating that nothing really was changing, we were highlighting more what appeared to be a successful upper class of African Americans who were being slowly highlighted, if you will, publicized in corporate America, et cetera. But proportionally, it really didn't mean anything because the white population was continuing to grow at an even more accelerated rate. And as we moved through the remainder of the 80s, 90s, and into 2000, we became almost obsessed with the sense that, well, you know, things have really improved and there's really no problem and we really don't need civil rights and et cetera. And then very conservative think tanks began to highlight, propagandize, if you will, infiltrate, saturate into the thinking. And, of course, in some respects, the worst thing that probably ever happened to the passion of revolution was with the election of Barack Obama of Illinois, because you're really being beat up now with what are you people complaining about? What are you Negroes concerned about? You got a, you know, you got a colored man in the White House,
yeah.
If you will, you know. He represents a success story, and so it becomes like one dimension. It's kind of like the whole thing about the Forbes piece that's come out, where they talk in terms of the richest Americans and et cetera. And of course, the richest Black American is Oprah Winfrey, and God exactly. bless her, but Oprah's way down there at about 2 billion. Bill Gates is up at, if I'm not mistaken, something like 53 billion.
Yeah, you are correct. He's at, yeah. They have him here, net worth in, 50 billion. And then right behind him, I actually have the top 100. And we're looking at 1, Bill Gates, 2, Warren Buffett, 3, Lawrence Ellison from Oracle. And then 4, 5, and 6 are all the Walton of the Walmart family.
That's right. In fact, they're 6 through 10, if I'm not mistaken, as we're taking
yes.
a look at this.
Yes, exactly. Video.
Now, it takes us back to back to your question. I think one of the most devastating pieces of research that has come out in just the last 10 days is something that also we were talking about during the week in the other different mediums that we are involved in, and that was this startling report from a very prestigious white research institute that deals with economic development, which includes jobs. And, in fact, it led to the local paper here, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, after they had heard comments by us, that you're using eyes, you on your blog, I on blog, and television program, et cetera, and an editorial that says, this is one list we'd rather not top. And what's happened to our listeners, Don, it's important that they understand that the study showed that this city represents the most significant and widest gap, 3.1, in fact, of employment versus unemployment between blacks and whites. And it gives one a better understanding that in these cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul, metropolitan area, black folk do not get employment. And I think you've got some additional statistics there. The silence, though, has been deafening. Our congressional delegation has said nothing. Neither senators have said nothing. The black congressman, Keith Ellison, out of the 5th Congressional, has said nothing. Our 2 black state representatives have said nothing. The Council on Black Minnesotans, which was created through the sweat and toil of blacks in this state, which does research, that's their responsibility, has said nothing. And then 2 days after the article came out, I'm listening to the head, well, not the head, he's the number two person over at the Northwest Area Foundation, who had made grand announcements and allegedly set aside and actually met in retreat out in Idaho because they were going to come out with a research report which talked in terms of the economic firmness of the African-American community, except when they had the meeting, which you attended out there and were not allowed the opportunity to go in. I can well remember the discussion. In fact, when Mr. Cunningham, Gary Cunningham, was the number two man at the Northwest Area Foundation, actually met you at the door with security guards, told you you would not be allowed to come in. But Mr. Cunningham and that whole elk, if you will, were to have developed a study and have made pronouncements between October of last year and April of this year about the economic stability or lack of within the African-American community. It never happened, but then they all got blindsided. And so it was interesting to hear Mr. Cunningham and Myron Arfield, who is a recognized expert in the area of, you know, social policy and et cetera, trying to explain. But Myron Arfield was at least honest enough to say what has happened is that Minneapolis and St. Paul, particularly Minneapolis, is recognized as one of the most segregated cities, both economically, educationally, and otherwise, in the United States. And so I think it's important that our listening audience understand the kind of environment and dichotomy that that exists in this so-called great liberal enclave.
Yeah, and I would just like to say that right now, almost in half hour into the show, that guests are welcome to call in at our toll-free number, which is 1-877-572-4288. Again, that toll-free call-in number is 1-877-572-4288. We'll be taking calls in just a minute. I see some callers there, but I just want to go into something real quick. Mr. Edwards, also this week, you know, I tell you, from your advice, you know, to always go back in to the archive and listen and read what some of our spokespersons in the community have said about the recent violence. And I, you know, when you told me that years ago, I don't even want to age myself or date myself because that's something very important. It's a piece that has proven very significant for me on my blog, videos, and asking people questions is to reference what they've said in the past. And I stumbled upon, you know, since we were talking about the Northwest Area Foundation, it was right there. This Gary Cunningham, second in charge of the Northwest Area Foundation, did an interview on January 27th, 2010, when the three Somalian gentlemen were shot and killed in South Minneapolis right on Franklin Avenue there at their store.
Right.
And the title of the interview with Brant Williams, talking to Mr. Cunningham and others, was in Minneapolis, why the jump in homicides? And I read this I was very skeptical because one of the things he said in that interview is that men, and I quote, men have gotten out of prison and come back into the community. We have a higher rate of violence, okay? What I said to him in this story is while this is a convenient and political explanation, it has little to do with the current homicides that are happening here in Minneapolis. We know, you and I, Mr. Edwards, and our listeners, that men have been leaving prison and being reintegrated into the community for decades. And most of them, they go to halfway houses or programs designed to help them find their footing, okay? While it would be, you know, while it would be nice from some people's point of view to keep these lower-income black men locked up forever, that doesn't solve any problems. More to the point, it's not a cause of the recent homicides in Minneapolis. And with that said, I continue to go into some detail because, to me, this is a neglect of an area. It's equivalent to a crime of apartheid, okay?
Yes, good point.
Like in 2010 here in Minneapolis, we have a system of organized racial and social economic apartheid that has to be addressed. And the current spokespersons and the individuals are not, you know, doing what they need to do. But it looks like we have a caller here. Let me take this call.
Okay.
Yes, caller, you're live on the air, on point with Ron Edwards and Don Allen. Hello, caller. Okay. Well, hopefully they'll call back. Let's just hang up there.
Looks like we may be having the same problem we had last week.
Yeah, well, some people aren't on their computers, and what I found out last week is that if you're calling in and you want it, you can't listen on the phone because what it does is it jams up the switchboard, and you'll get cut off, and the other callers aren't going to be able to call in. But if you want to call in, just call in and ask a question. Again, that number is 1-877-572-4288. Well, what do you think, Mr. Edwards, is the systemic reason why we have such a screwed up town with these, I used to call them self-appointed spokespersons. And I don't understand why we can't see. Minneapolis has a small African-American or black, like I say, population where it seems not only a Band-Aid, but stitches and the wound could heal. And we could grow to some prosperity here and some type of unity and get above this hump of economic, you know, despair. But
well, let me cut in and say, okay. Things really began to happen when urban renewal came in the 1950s, Don, when the heart of the black economic base, a showcase community called 6th Avenue North, which is Highway 55 / Olson Highway. From basically 1921 until 1952, the Negro community, quote-unquote, had a thriving commercial district. Likewise for St. Paul in what is now referred to as the so-called Rondo neighborhood. There were commercial businesses. And you have to understand that you have to relate to this per the times, if you will. Let's just take the period 1924-25. A black theater, motion picture okay. theater, if you will, at least six black physicians, if you will. The largest employer of Negroes in 1924 was a black-owned laundry employing better than 200 black workers at a time when the census indicated the official black population in Minneapolis was a little over 6,000, in St. Paul was a little over 4,000. A single business employing 200 Negroes at well-paying jobs for the particular times, if you will.
Okay.
There were bakeries, there were cafes, there was the well-known supper club where national entertainers came in. There were hotels. There was a place called the Keystone Building, which was a recreational facility. Where there were black businesses, pool halls, and et cetera, barbershops. But these were facilities that were making money, returning and keeping the money in the Negro community and employing Negroes, okay? The black or Negro community was being pushed out of the Seven Corners area, but there was a place for relocation with vitality. That was the key. When urban renewal came in 1951-52, and by 1953, it was kind of like Greenwood in Tulsa, Oklahoma. 6th Avenue North was gone. Many of the Negro businesses were lied to. I remember we actually had a relocation agency that did nothing, if you will. And so that economic foundation was not only fractured, but it was cracked, and it ultimately by 1960-61 collapsed. This is the reason, Don, that by 1964-65, there had began to be public denunciations of the system, and by 1964, there began to be insurgency or uprisings. Some people called them riots. It's all in the eyes of the beholder. Others called them a response to the suppression and obstruction of the black race, if you will. And by 1967, there were National Guard. In July of 1967, the governor at that time had to call National Guard into the streets of Minneapolis, and particularly North Minneapolis, and the Guard had to stay for over a week. And we never recovered from that. There was a sense of, such as what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinians, white politicians by 1968 were talking in terms of collective punishment for the black community, and what people, and I know what I'm getting ready to say to you is something we wrote about way back in the 60s. It did not sit well with a lot of people, including a lot of quote-unquote Negroes, is what is called collective punishment. Mm-hmm. And that is that for the actions of one or two, the entire entity, in this case race, will be held accountable and a victim of the collective punishment. And Don, I have to tell you, that since 1968 that the African-American community has been the recipient, unfortunately, of collective punishment for their uprising in the mid-1960s as an outgrowth of the collapse of the black economic base and other kinds of opportunities coming out of the 1950s. It's a fact. In fact, Don, in 1980, the Minneapolis Urban League, which at that time I was the chairman of the board, in 1977, we had started an effort because we did not have a research entity. All research was done by white entities, and we were told that, you know, we just needed to depend on them. You know, we didn't need to be bothered with research and data. Well, by 1980, we were able to get a number of grants, and we created in the Urban League, we had really grown at that time, over 100 employees and et cetera. We created a research department, and we brought in a man by the name of Dexter Clark, and we had a department of two. Mr. Clark had an assistant. And in 1980, we issued the first report on the state of black Minnesota, okay? And in that 1980 report, highlights of this impending problem if it was not addressed, including employment and education and et cetera. 2 years later, because this brings us into the crime and justice situation, a young white girl by the name of Christine Kurtz was shot and killed execution style in Martin Luther King Park on Nicollet Avenue. We pointed out that this was a part of, unfortunately, drug and gang culture that it was beginning to emerge because of the economic deficit that we were suffering. Then Mayor Don Frazier and then Police Chief Tony Boza said that was just a bunch of bluff. There was no problem with gangs or drugs, and that some of us, and particularly yours truly, were just trying to stir up stuff. Now, you have to understand, from that point on, this city received hundreds of millions of dollars almost clandestinely to fight the problem of gangs and drugs.
Oh, wow. Okay. I had a caller. Just screened her. She was there. Ma'am?
Are you talking to me?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, this is Mary Harris. How are you, dear?
I'm fine, Ms. Harris. This is the Minneapolis Janet Sensation, Mary Harris, on the air with on point with
Ron. Good afternoon, Ms. Harris.
Hi. I want you to know, now I'm just listening, but I keep getting bumped off of the bus. Every time I get knocked off, I just keep coming back, okay? I don't have a comment. I just keep bouncing back, okay? So thank you all for being willing to say your opinions. I don't agree, I don't disagree. I just really appreciate, though, you taking advantage of our birthright to be able to say what's in our minds and in our hearts. I really appreciate that, and I acknowledge y'all for that, okay?
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I'll go back on mute. Thank you.
Okay, there we go. That was really great. In continuing and still staying on topic here, I was just looking at some research, especially in North Minneapolis, because that seems to be where the highest economic disparity is, or for lack of a better word, a serious issue and problem in jobs, education, health care, health and wellness, et cetera. And I, not to my shock, because you know I knew it was going on anyway. You have, like I said, 200 nonprofit agencies.
209, isn't it? Because I've seen a couple of bloggers have said 209.
Yes. And I'm just trying to be conservative with the number by nine, I guess. But there's 209, we'll say, nonprofit agencies. This includes parks and churches. About 165 of those in their articles of incorporation, bylaws, and mission statements say that they focus on economic development, youth violence, educational component, after-school tutoring programs, a variety of things that I would say for the last maybe 10, 15, maybe more years than that have not really been addressed successfully. One thing that people have to know about nonprofits is a nonprofit is successful, or a social service, human service agency that is not run by the state, but that is run organized in the community with a grassroots effort. An organization like that is successful when it closes, which means, one, its mission was successful. Two, the people that it served are doing 100% better than that what they were doing. when the nonprofit first opened. This would give the nonprofit opportunity to take this model that worked with successful measurable outcomes and maybe go to Cleveland, Chicago, Detroit, another city with the same kind of economic or human service situations. But here in the Twin Cities or in Minneapolis, just more specifically North Minneapolis, what we have is a perpetual funding machine for our nonprofits that just virtually, you know, rarely show a successful measurable outcome. And I have not been real clear on that. And what is your take on that, Mr. Edwards?
Well, first of all, what I will do, because the presence of documentation is always important, particularly in this town. If not, you get telephone calls late at night. From crazies.
Yeah.
Don, it's interesting the hypothesis that you just laid out, because there is a move afoot to mute these kinds of observations. In fact, if they could mute this this blog radio, they would do it. On March 19, 2010, at University Lutheran Hope, University Lutheran Church of Hope, there was a meeting, a very interesting meeting. And the purpose of the meeting was to talk in terms of the agenda for North Minneapolis. Now, this was held in Southeast Minneapolis. And just for anybody that wants to jump up, we have been, as a part of our intelligence operations, we have a list of all the participants, of many of y'all that showed up over there. And the featured organization was the Peace Foundation.
Yes.
And who have increased their funding from $300,000 in basic OAID to over a million and better. And, of course, the document filed with the state of Minnesota for the year 2008 shows $388,567 in total revenue. Their document that should have been filed, which has still not been filed for 209, will show over $1 million, in which the director and deputy director are paid $65,000 and $57,000. And, you know, for anybody that that wants to question this, it's on the document, required for annual reporting only. Oops. And Sonia and Miss Michelle Martin are identified, as well as the board. Now, I said all that to respond to your question, that there is a document called a call to action, which is purports to deal with how to deal with the youth problem. Oops. And it is basically coordinated by the Youth Coordinating Board. And it's rather interesting, and it's consistent with some of the actions that are now taking place at UROC, as an example. Bottom line on this is that there is as opposed to a plan to save lives, take corrective actions, try to bring a healthy environment back into the black community, the plan is, number one, to mute any examination of what is or is not happening. I repeat that again, Don. To mute any examination of what is or is not happening, if you will, basically discredit the information, if you will, the data, the research, and et cetera, and then move ahead with what really borders on, and you said it earlier in this program this afternoon, to move towards an enforced policy of apartheid and genocide. And that is what is happening to the African-American population. North Minneapolis, though, has been identified as a Pacific proving ground, if you will, okay, like Los Alamos, White Sands. I mean, I hate to say it that way and that crudely. And so what has happened is that our community and our people, and particularly our young, are a part of an experiment. They're like guinea pigs. But when you are able to capture the information about the meetings, about the discussions that are going on, about, and I use the word again, how the concerns must be muted, okay, then that's what's at the top of the agenda. That's why, concentrating early in this program, I put so much emphasis on the report coming out of Washington, D.C. Now, you have to understand, this was not a report that was done here. And, in fact, the head of the entity inside of the Research Institute called the Unit on employment, race, and poverty indicated a real lack of cooperation back in the Twin Cities. But these folks who do a lot of things for the government, et cetera, have the resources and the money, and so they just went around the Minnesota Department of Economic Development and others and went and got the information and the data and et cetera. Now you're what you talked about earlier and what you have spoken to on your blog. In fact, I had received a couple calls earlier this morning in which you are raising questions about, you know, what not only what has been done, but why the attacks on attempting to raise the right questions and expose the cancer, if you will. As I said before, and then I'll cut it off, the energy that's being spent is a negative energy. It is an energy to suppress what is happening and what is befalling the sons and daughters of the African, okay, as opposed to energy to talk in terms of corrective action. I talked to a young man last night in closing who was at the center point of the effort in 2005 when certain quote-unquote leaders went out to General Mills and met with Ellen Luger and them, and they invested some money, but the real purpose was to send the young people in a different direction, a negative direction. And he was in tears because a friend of his had just been shot on Broadway, I think in front of KMOJ. And he was talking about the shootings. We have more shootings here in Minneapolis than people can even begin to understand. The only time we really report a shooting is when it's DOA, dead on arrival, a fatality. And so I think this is something we need to be taking a look here at On Point over the next couple of weeks, because people are trying to pretend that the black community did not recognize this problem. And I take you back to the study in 1980, Don, entitled The State of Black Minnesota by Dexter Clark, then head of the research department at the Minneapolis Urban League. It's all there.
Yeah, and it's like you said, you told me to go back and look in the past and look at these different articles and different statements from these people, and they're walking around with their mouths open like they're shocked, like, oh, I can't believe this. But like you said, this is an opportunity for them to obstruct, deny, block, whatever other adjective or word you want to use, this information and get it in the mainstream. I mean, this has to be corrected. And I was walking through the Juneteenth today, and I had a gentleman come up to me who wishes to remain anonymous, and I'll respect that, but he says,
okay.
He says, man, why are you always beating up the black community on your blog? And I says, explain beating up the black community. And he says, well, you're telling everybody's business. I says,
tell everybody's business. Wow.
Telling everybody's business. And I says, well, what do you mean by telling everybody's business? And he says, well, you know, you put this stuff out there about KMOJ, about the Northwest Area Foundation, Gary Cunningham, the second in charge, and that brother's a well-respected brother. And then he went on to say, well, why do you do this? And I had to sit there and explain to him. I says, are you currently employed? He says, no.
Right.
I says, where do you live at? He says, North Minneapolis. I said, where would you go in North Minneapolis with your college degree that I know this brother has?
Okay.
And ask them to pipeline you into a job for engineering, which you have a degree in, a four-year degree, so that you can become more productive and live the dream that you want to live by, you know, your sacrificing and going to college and having $100,000 in financial aid debt. Where would you go? And he stood there and looked at me and said, you know, you're right. I have to go to a white agency. I said, and if you go there, they're not going to get you a job anyway because they say you're overqualified. And he said, now I made him look at it in a whole different perspective. I said, this is not beating up the community. This is not attacking the black community. It's just for almost, I mean, Mr. Edwards, you've been writing a column and a spokesman forever, okay?
Right.
And this is an opportunity that I took to put on a blog because this information is being suppressed. I mean, look at the cover of Insight News.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? You will have no clue. The only reason that you know that it's in Minneapolis is because there's a picture of Channel 9, Fox 9 News, former anchor Robin Robinson there.
Right.
Okay, there's a picture of Shonda Baker, who's running for school board still.
Right.
Other than that, you look through that newspaper and you think that everything is beautiful where we have a black community. Some of us have the potential and the resources to bring attention to these disparities and address these disparities in a powerful way while making money, because that's an important part of it. But yet they choose not to. Now, getting back to now, we have 15 minutes left in the show here, and again, we invite callers to call in at 1-877-572-4288. Again, that number is 1-877-572-4288. But getting back into the nonprofit thing, I had a chance on Friday to visit a nonprofit in North Minneapolis. And I'm at this point, I'm going to just leave it nameless because people know what I'm talking about. I'm sure some of the pundits and cronies are listening to it because they're from my friends on Facebook, and I advertise as well. But there was a green, quote-unquote, gathering at, it was called Green the Ghetto in North Minneapolis. And while I am pulling it up here because I have to just let you know what's going on here. They had Majora Carter, who is a green economist consultant and social innovator. They had Matt Contenza, who is the DFL candidate for governor. And they also had Robin Robinson. And
his running mate for lieutenant governor, right.
Running mate for lieutenant governor. And I thought it very strange to walk into a 501c3 nonprofit educational institution or hub and see Matt Contenza for governor signed all on the windows. In the beginning, they were out front with Matt Contenza signs. Now, if you look at the Minnesota statute, well, we're going to go one step up. If you look at the 501c3 statutes for political activity at a nonprofit, it is clearly denied against the law and should not even be. You know, it doesn't happen, because if you walk across the street from this place to the university, the Minneapolis Urban League has a sign saying that no political information, flyers, brochures can be hung up in the building, according to the IRS 501c3 statutes of, you know, and it's there, and it's not happening. It's not going to happen in the Urban League. So why was this place across the street, why was Matt Intenza's campaign allowed to plaster the place with signs? And I might be overstating it, because I've seen Keith Ellison, Bobby Joe Champion, Linda Higgins, Don Samuel, all politicians here locally, Jeff Hayden, and others have DFL Love Fest in that room, but not one sign was hung up. And if these guys have to apply to the rule, what makes Mr. Intenza's campaign not apply? But let me just take you back 2 minutes. Last year, about this time, 2009, Congressman Keith Ellison called together a bunch of quote-unquote community spokespersons. Randolph Statton was in the room. Mr. Bill English was in the room. A couple other folks was in the room, including Lenny Chisholm, who is the executive director of Springboard. So Lenny said, "Did I want to crash a party?" And, you know, I'm always up for crashing a party. And so he didn't tell me where he was taking me, but we went to the South Minneapolis Urban League, where sat Matt McKenzie and Congressman Keith Ellison. And Keith Ellison was basically presenting Matt McKenzie to the room of quote-unquote community spokesperson, telling him that this guy is, in paraphrasing, the great white hope, that this is a man you should support. And I was shocked, because Mr. Edwards, we were talking about this earlier. We have had our people in our community promise jobs for the community. 2,000 jobs, I think, in 2007, 3,000 jobs in 2008, another 3,000, 5,000 jobs in 2009, another couple thousand jobs in 2010, which none of them has happened. They barely hire staff to work at these places, okay?
Absolutely, absolutely.
They have this big green innovator, you know, and I'm pretty sure she was playing ball. But they come into this nonprofit and basically had a campaign rally for Matt Contenza. Now, I quietly crept out and went and printed up a copy of the 501c3 kind of rules of engagement for political activity at nonprofit. And When he was done, I filmed Robin Robinson talking, and if you look at these videos are on IBNNnews.org, where Robin Robinson clearly gave a campaign rally speech talking about the Green Initiative. But getting back to that job thing real quick, because I know I'm bouncing around a little, Mr. Attendant said, yeah, we're going to get 50,000 jobs in the community with this Green Initiative. We need green roofs in North Minneapolis. We need solar panels on these roofs. We need... And I'm just looking at him, I'm like, wow, you just don't know your history. Another thing, if you guys haven't read the book or seen the movie, The Spook Who Sat by the Door, it's a good thing to watch, because this applies exponentially to Mr. Matt Intenza's campaign. He has hired a bunch of African-American runners, as I'll call them right now, our campaign personnel, and one of his campaign personnel who actually put this event together, confronted me a couple times because I thought that Green in the Ghetto was inappropriate for Minneapolis or the Twin Cities, because there are no ghettos in the Twin Cities, and I don't see how any political candidate who's been in the House of Representatives or ran for Minnesota Attorney General or has a very detailed resume that I have in front of me has never even been over until now when he's running for governor. And I feel bad for former Fox 9 News anchor Robin Robinson, because I think that she should get the short end of the stick, especially when Mr. Mark Layton starts turning up the heat. So, yeah, with that said, I was a little troubled. Mr. Intenza's response to me was that I need to spend my time doing something productive. I raised my hand during the question and answer session, and he basically looked over me 3 or 4 times. But Mr. Intenza is firmly on the radar right now, and I just don't think, you know, having that slave mentality attitude or that master servant attitude in North Minneapolis, or giving the appearance that he's down with the brothers, is going to work for him at all. So.
I fully agree, but that's a part of the modus operandi, Don, that has come into play since November of 2008. This certain level of arrogance that is a representation of white privilege. Interesting statement made to you about doing something productive, because again, productivity is in the eyes of the beholder, and if you, as a African American, a son of the sons and daughters of Africa, if you will, are exposing what is a continued sham, then in your eyes and in the eyes of those that believe and support you, that's productive, okay?
Very productive, yes.
Yeah. What's non-productive is for a white candidate who should know better, who is set in the legislature and knows the kinds of discussions that have gone on both on the floor of the House and the Senate and in committee. And then someone should have given him a copy of the Star Tribune's editorial, and definitely, most definitely, Matt Intenza should go read the report given to the House Committee on June 9th by the Research Institute, in which the head of the Research Institute indicated that Minneapolis, the problem and the disparity, was being driven by racism. Maybe Matt and others can discuss racism, because, by the way, that is one of the discussions that never takes place anymore in a political campaign. How do we deal with racism in Minnesota, okay? And it's kind of like that's a no-no, if you will, that we're just one happy colony, if
yeah.
you will, of good Christians, if you will, which, and I say that because it's also a part of the insult to the multiplicity of other religions and et cetera that are in place. But there's a certain arrogance, and I think that arrogance, unfortunately, is breeding what is becoming a very, very hostile environment based on race relations, not only here in the state of Minnesota, but across the country. And it's really regrettable. But what I want to reinforce in the 4 or 5 minutes that we have left here is that for those that want to and that have the interest and, in some cases, the ability, need to go back and research and examine some of the documents and the studies that were put forward by African Americans, blacks, Negroes, whatever, however the definition is that you're comfortable with, in which the black community sent a signal and recognized this impending action, this action being genocide, if you will, obstruction of the opportunities for African Americans, for their young, and et cetera. Because one of the things that I see Ahmad Atenza and others doing is that they are attempting to insult us as African Americans by dismissing the fact that we are relevant because we didn't even understand the problem. We have well understood the problem in this state and across the country and across the planet, but right now we're concentrating on Minnesota. In fact, we have articulated the problem, and in many cases have articulated solutions for the problem much better than any of them with their great think tanks and tremendous, tremendous resources could ever have thought about. It's really unfortunate that during the time that Matt was a mover and shaker and you know, still is in the legislature, that he was not in the forefront of encouraging the party leadership, both Democrats and Republicans, to maybe concentrate a little bit better on the problem of race that was affecting education and such. See, we haven't even touched on, and by the way, the test scores will be coming out in a couple of weeks, and the unofficial word from reliable sources that deal with the firm that compiles the information is the next set of test scores for the Mass public schools, absolute disaster.
Yes, but that's what we've been hearing. We're getting a little buzz about that on and off, and that's going to be very interesting when those final test scores do come out. But getting back, we have four minutes left here, but you just said something very important, Mr. Edwards. No one on any of these political campaigns, from the Democrat, the Republican, the Green, the Independent, no one has discussed race at all whatsoever, or racism in the community, or issues that involve the African-American community of even North Minneapolis or John.
John, let me just cut in and tell you again. Take a look at the agenda and the discussions held on March 19, 2010 at University Lutheran Church of Hope with some of our quote-unquote leaders participating in that discussion that talked in terms of suppressing those kinds of discussions.
Yeah, and that's not good at all. That affects everybody in a very bad way. And, I mean, I'm riding that Matt Atenza train here for a minute because he just really rubbed me the wrong way. I'm just looking at him because him taking me on Robin Robinson as a lieutenant governor to run with him, I thought that would be a really good move. But after my two conversations with Robin Robinson, I was really worried about her, and she seems pretty clueless at this point. And I told her, if you want, you look at my blog sometimes, just read some of those stories. If you want to address issues in the community, read the Minneapolis story, read Mr. Edwards' story in the Spokesman Recorder every week. I mean, that would give you enough information there to come out and talk intelligently about what's going on and say how you address the issues. Of course, you know, you can see it flying one ear and out the other.
Right. And again, like I said, that is most regrettable. Don, in basically the last minute and a half ahead, I would suggest that we keep a real close eye on the level of violence. It has to be of great concern to our community. The word is out that this will be an ongoing pattern if we don't reach an understanding with respect to a strategy to approach this, and one of the key portions of that strategy is the importance of employing young persons, male and female of color, and specifically in our cases, young African Americans. There are just no jobs now. The park board has been saying that they have 800 or 900 jobs, that 1,000 that are forthcoming. Dick Mammon, who has been presiding guru over there, a understanding better the black community than black people understand themselves, has had some of his minions running out saying that there are all kinds of jobs that the park board has ready right now. I would suggest for those that are tuned in, you need to call first thing Monday over to the park board, and if you have a young person in your household, or if you are a young person, you need to find out what happened with respect to those jobs. And for those of you that made application 2 months ago, need to find out what happened to your application.
Okay. And within our last minute here, there's a show coming on tonight, and they've always been good to on point. Black Lion City, tonight my guest is Mark A. Wingo. They call it Mr. Wingonomics. Be tonight on Twin Cities Radio. Tonight, the number is 917.
889-3130. There's a call-in number. Just go to Blog Talk Radio and look for Black Twin Cities Radio. It's Black Twin Cities Radio tonight, night Blog Talk Radio. We'd also like to remind our listeners to watch Black Focus on Sunday at 5 p.m. on Channel 17, which is Minneapolis Television Network. And Mr. Edwards has a weekly article at www.spokesman-recorder.com. That's the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder. Thanks for listening. And you've been listening to On Point with Don Allen and Ron Edwards.
Thank you. I'll give you a call back on your cell.